Hello, everyone. Hello, and welcome to Capture Reveal. My name is Piotr. I'm here with my co-host, Ricky. Hey, Ricky.
Hey, everybody. Happy Friday. It's Friday. Finally.
I like Mondays as well, to be honest. I think Mondays are better. Fridays are overrated. Seriously.
What? Not when you've got my week was terrible. It was just overwhelming. It wasn't terrible, but it was me sitting in front of a computer over 12 hours a day. I didn't get out of the house until yesterday. So today is, I'll get out of the house today again, but it's just been overwhelmed with work and
fingers
other things.
Crossed.
Yeah, fingers crossed.
I mean,
for sure.
To get out, at least for a 5 minutes walk or something like that.
To see the sun on your face. Yeah, I mean, the other times that I would get out, it was just to like run an errand, which is nothing.
Yeah,
I mean,
it is not. I get it. I mean, not a walk or something, just to absorb the sunlight.
Yeah.
To get some VD going. On your plot.
That's right, vitamin D.
Okay, so I think today we'll talk about something that we've mentioned last time, which is Harry Potter TV series. But before we get to it and some other things, like the question we got from Erwan, one of our listeners, I want to congratulate Alex on winning Taco Bell Film Festival. Ricky, you've seen the film that he has won with. So,
yeah. So if you've watched and listened to our podcast, we had Alex Familian on a while ago, and he edited the movie, the short film and the feature film Appendage, which was on Hulu. And so we follow him on the Instagram, and so I noticed that he was submitting to the Taco Bell Film Fest, which, if you don't know, Taco Bell has a film fest. That sentence probably nobody ever would have thought that he'd been hear or say, but it's true. And Alex Familian has won it with his short film Backrooms Vacation, which if you end up seeing it, it's completely bizarre. It's 4 minutes long, and he essentially made it in Unreal Engine. So it was his attempt at learning Unreal Engine and just like coming up with something wacky. Him and his wife came up with the idea and they just put it together.
That's so cool.
Yeah,
it's so cool. I need to see it. I need to see it. I'll message Alex.
It's ridiculous. It's so ridiculous, but it's bizarre, and it has kind of like a feel of like a horror film and the movie Us, because it's whatever, and then it kind of just goes. Yeah,
nice.
I mean, just like the setting of it, the backroom setting of it makes it get that feeling, but it's a. Yeah, you'll see it and you'll be like, what the fuck? And then he won. And I was like, I was like, what did you win? Taco Bell for life? And he's like, I got a bunch of gift cards and a bunch of Taco Bell swag. And I was like, oh my God, did you get sunglasses? Like Taco Bell sunglasses? He was like, I wish. I was like, oh, if I had Taco Bell sunglasses, I'd be wearing them on the red carpet every time. And he was like, I'm going to eat Taco Bell on the red carpet. That's going to be my thing now. So it was funny.
It's awesome. By the way, if you want to listen to the episode with Alex, it's episode 12 from the first season. So you can check this out. Alex was actually very helpful when I reached out to him before directing Yellow Ticket. Yeah, just wanted to get some tips, I guess, on directing on set and how to prepare, what to, set my mind to. And he was very helpful, very grateful to Alex for that. Regarding festivals, I just wanted to say that I didn't get into Cannes, which is something I knew I wouldn't, but still just wanted to confirm this time, because I mentioned this last week that I probably didn't get there. I mean, I'm pretty sure I didn't, but the reason I want to talk about this is, first of all, to share my failure, because, it's cool just to talk about success stuff, right, when it happens. But, like, we get rejected all the time, so why not talk about this, first of all? But secondly, I want to talk about how many films were selected versus how many short films were submitted. Because that number for Cannes is just out of this earth. Seriously, like, the chances of being selected are so, so freaking low. So guess how many films have been selected? Short films competition.
I mean, I'm looking at the numbers right now. So you
okay. So you I forgot that you can see the numbers. Good. So 11 films were selected out of 4,420 submitted.
That's insane.
Insane. Insane. To get into Cannes is like...
That's a big deal. From where I'm sitting when it comes to Cannes, it seems like there's a bunch of films popping off there, more than 11, you know, just with all the fanfare and things getting, because it is a festival, so that they only pick 11, which are those 11 and which are those are in like the official film festival, and then what are the other ones that are just kind of like on the outliers?
I mean, just the short films, right?
Yeah.
Those are the numbers just for the short films.
Oh, okay. Well, there you go.
So when it comes to features, I think they select like 56 features altogether.
Oh,
I think something like that
makes more sense.
Something like that.
Yeah.
And they also have like they have like few selections. So there's mm-hmm. like the main competition. Yeah. There is just like special screenings that are out of competition, but you know, are still about like new features being released and stuff like that. So there are a bunch of things, but when it comes to short films, 11 out of 4,420.
That's still
quite a number. Okay, Ricky. So, Harry Potter TV series coming from Maximilian.
Yeah.
They've changed the name. I don't know. If they wanted the name of a human, why not pick a John or something like that? I don't know. John or Jack.
What?
Max. I mean... Sorry, I'm just like wondering, like, what's wrong with HBO? I'm not sure.
Oh, it's because it's two companies combined. And the other
Still,
one was called,
like HBO was Cinemax. It's a good brand.
Well, yeah, I don't know. They combined with Cinemax, and so then they just called it Max. Who knows why people do these things?
I would call it John.
when we start our own streaming service, we'll call it John.
Exactly. That's a promise.
You heard it here, everybody. Write this down, listeners.
Okay, so what do you think about this? Like, I've heard like mixed opinions about what to expect from such a series, and I am very optimistic about what it's gonna be.
Yeah. So because my wife and I are big Harry Potter fans. My wife has a Harry Potter tattoo. I am and regularly reread the books almost every year. And we watch the movies. That's like comfort food for us. So we heard about it. And, you know, it's kind of like you want to turn up your head at it. Like, turn up your nose at it because it's like a money grab. Usually remakes and stuff, they already have their own. They have a built-in audience that are just going to throw money at it regardless of how good or bad the film, series, franchise, or whatever. So, you know, thinking of it from that sense, it's kind of annoying. That being said, using it and creating Harry Potter the series, you know, as it's, you know, they're trying to make it more true to the books, and with the series you can make things live longer and really flesh out the details compared to the movies. But there's a, you know, the article that you had sent me that we're talking about is like remaking it, even though they'll probably get it closer to the books, it'll still be kind of an uphill battle, because if you're going to essentially create a career for these actors, like they're starting out young and we're watching them grow up before our eyes in the same way that the movies did, in the same way that the books, you know, were following Harry and his friends through life. And it's just hard when you've got young kids and you're expecting them to be a certain level of acting. And so, you know, those first two movies, Chamber of Secrets and The Sorcerer's Stone, are kind of terrible, you know, and it's just the way it is. And to be honest, my wife and I, whenever we watch them, it's very rare that we watch the first two movies. We always start with Prisoner of Azkaban, and we go from there. But I think that, yeah, there's that struggle with the consistency.
My wife read the books as an adult, and she didn't read them as a kid. And we wanted to watch the movies once she finished all of the books. And we started with the first one. We turned it off in the middle, and we didn't watch it again.
Yeah.
None of them. None of them. I mean, I've seen all of them, right? But my wife didn't. The reason is, yeah, the acting is terrible in those first two. But I actually disagree with that article. And I think that the series is very promising. Mm-hmm. First of all, it's coming from, let me call it HBO, okay? I mean, I'm not calling it
that's
HBO
fine.
To...
That's fine.
Because, like, you know, HBO usually stands for quality. At least that's what it mm-hmm. always was in my mind. HBO equals quality. and I think they will not disappoint. And, you know, the premise is that we will get one book into one season of the series.
Right.
And, you know, I'm pretty sure if I would write a show like this, I wouldn't just focus on the book. I wouldn't just follow, like, you know, chapter one, chapter two, chapter three, chapter four, and go on like that. And I don't think that they're gonna do it either. I think if you turn it into a series, something that's already actually like a feature film, mm-hmm. then you get a lot of playground to play on, right? Because you can actually mix like different timelines, and you can even different books. I think you can mix even different books without like mixing them. For example, there is this, correct me if I'm wrong, but we meet the creator of the Philosopher's Stone in later books, right?
No.
No?
No, he doesn't come back. Nicholas Flamel is the guy who has the Philosopher's Stone. He is mentioned in the first book, and he might be mentioned later on, but he doesn't ever show up in the books as a character. They have him in the movies of, what's it called? The new movies. Oh my God, help me out here with the monsters,
I mixed this up. Okay, I get it. Fantastic Beasts.
Yeah, Fantastic Beasts. He comes up in that, but he doesn't come up in the books.
Okay, so that's my bad. That's how I don't know. I somehow merged Harry Potter and Fantastic Beasts together in my head. I get it. Yeah, but still, like you get the chance, for example, right? Because they talk about Dumbledore knowing Flamel and stuff like that in the first book. So you could open, theoretically, right? You could open the show on Dumbledore and Flamel and their story, and you could add to it. And I'm pretty sure that if they want J.K. Rowling to help out with the writing, and I think they will, then I'm pretty sure she will use it as an occasion to actually like go a little bit deeper and add some bits to the stories that we know from the book. So I don't think it will be copy, like one-to-one copy of the books to like a screenplay format. I think it will be an opportunity to extend and to build on top of it. And that's what excites me. That's what excites me. I think there is an opportunity, and the way to make it Harry Potter series, but like giving a lot of screen time to other actors and other characters instead of just Harry Potter, right?
When I was younger and this would have come out, I would have been pissed. I'd been like, what are they doing? They're, you know, people, and they're over dramatic. They ruined my childhood. We didn't read the books when we were kids. We read them as adults as well. So, you know, at a certain point, I think the movies are the movies, the books are the books, and this will be the series. And I think that I agree with you. Like, I acknowledge that having young actors are not going to give you the performances of an older actor. And not to say that there aren't exceptions. Stranger Things was brought up in that article, and I would agree with that.
Exactly.
And I think that the series will be the series, but it's not going to get as in-depth as the books will be. And I agree that they could probably bring in some other characters that we'll actually see rather than them just being like lines on a page or that don't even come in into the movies. I think it's going to be a mix of that where you'll have like if the books are 100% and the movies were 50%, then the series will probably be 75% or higher of, you know, of that story. But
yeah, but in my opinion, it will be 75 plus 10% we didn't get from any of these. Seriously, that's my prediction.
Yeah, I mean, the other thing, the one thing that also stands out to me is that, like, they kind of mentioned it in the article about Harry Potter movies, about Harry Potter as a character, like, he's not as snarky as he is in the books. And, like, in the books, these are very flawed characters. Like, there is from when I read it, there is never a time where I was like, where you're like rooting for Harry the entire time or Ron the entire time or Hermione, like everybody gets shitty and you're like, fuck Harry, fuck this dude. So like everybody's really flawed. So I'm curious as to how they're going to do that because, you know, there are points where you're in the ride. So, you know, eventually what's going to happen and stuff, but there are times where you're just like, I hope this happens to Harry. Cause fuck, he needs to get slapped in the face. Cause he's being a dick right now. Or he's, you know,
yes.
Why isn't Hermione listening to Harry? He knows what he's talking about. And everybody's got these flawed aspects of it. So that's going to be, you know, making characters that people are in love with, but portraying them as like real people, as real flawed characters. I'm curious to see how that's going to turn out. But I mean, that world is just so deep and so cool. So I'll watch it.
You know, TV series actually gives an opportunity to do this kind of stuff. I'm not sure if they could even do it in a feature, because a feature, like, again, like 2 hours, you can't lose the viewer in between. But if you can't lose the viewer in the TV series either, but you can refocus on a different character for a while and to see their perspective. I don't think you could do it in a feature when adapting a full book into a film. I'm not sure, but in the TV series, you can do it, I think. You can have an episode focus on the perspective of Ron's perspective, right? Rather than Harry, for example. You could have those when you actually think for one episode, you think like, okay, Harry is like, I don't know, out of his mind over here or whatever, right? You could play with those aspects, I think, which is something you couldn't do in a feature. So yeah, I'm excited about this. I really am.
Yeah, I watch it. Yeah, to that point, even in the books, there are only a few times where they really stray away from Harry and his story. And most of them are flashbacks or like in the very beginning, the very first book, that whole opening chapter isn't even about Harry. It's about the Dursleys and setting up like, these are the shitty people that are normal and we're getting in. And then even like when Snape and Malfoy's mother make the unbreakable curse or unbreakable vow, do we see something that isn't with Harry in it and whatever? So yeah, I agree. It'll be interesting to see how they do that and how that happens and where they get off the track. And, you know, I know that people are going to be losing their minds because I think a lot of people are like, this is trying to replace the Harry Potter movies.
Yeah, yeah. It's not trying to replace. I don't think they would do it. They wouldn't kind of. It's their content, by the way, I think, right? It's on Max, yeah. Right? So they wouldn't
cannibalize it?
Yeah, exactly. Thank you. I think it will be just another layer and another way to experience the story. And I think it will be deeper. I think it will be made for, okay, maybe I'm very wrong here because I thought that maybe it will be tailored to a little bit older audience than the movies. But I think that's going to be the case, even with Stranger Things, right? Stranger Things, like some kids watch them. I would never let my kids watch them. But I mean, my kids are young, right? But I've heard about parents who let their young children, like mine, watch TV series, watch Stranger Things. And kids, I don't know. They seem to be fine with this kind of content as well. So my kids, I guess, are very fragile. It's good. I want to keep them this way for a while.
Well, yeah, that's another thing is like, even with the movies and with the books, the way that they're written is that it's like a progression of, they become more mature. Like even the writing, like the very first book is for kids. And the very last book is for anything. I mean, it might be YA, but it's bordering on, you know, I don't know, adult, but not really adult. And it's the same with the movies, because the first two movies are like these little kids. And it doesn't get, I mean, with the exception of kind of really thinking about it, where, okay, at the end, at the end of the first movie, Harry Potter kills a man. You know, like, I don't know if anybody realized that, like, okay, this 11-year-old boy essentially kills somebody. But beyond that, once it starts getting darker and, you know, the whole motif and, you know, the color correction, at the very least, you can tell that it's just getting darker and darker. And at the very end, it's more towards, like, adults, we'll say. But yeah, I assume that, I can only guess that that's what the Harry Potter series is going to be like. But because it's on HBO, it's going to be a little bit harder, so it's not going to be necessarily like kid friendly. Exactly. Yeah, because it's not, I don't know that Harry Potter is leaps and bounds beyond a single demographic anymore, like maybe in the very beginning when the books first came out, but there's too many people that grew up with that are adults now, and people that are adults that are reading it, like us.
Okay, good. I think we'll get back to Harry Potter in the future episodes because it's interesting to see how it develops. By the way, I've seen that it hasn't been confirmed yet, but I think the showrunner is going to be, what's her name? Francesca Gardner, I think, who was the showrunner for Succession.
Oh, okay.
Wow. So, you know, you have quite a name over there. And I think the name alone, like, gives a premise of something big.
Yeah, for sure. The HBO isn't going to half-ass it, but we'll see what happens with the last season, because they seem to drop the ball, or everybody gets super upset at last season's for a few shows at HBO or Max or whatever you want. The John streaming series platform. Anyway, moving on.
What shall we talk about? About everyone's question?
We can, or if you want to just do a brief recap of last weekend, like your Premiere Pro workshop, if you want to talk about that, or later.
Yeah, why not? So I ran the workshop. It was fine. It was like, you know, 3 hours long pretty much. Most of the people just went out for the replay. So I had really like that there was just one person watching live.
And all right.
So this was a little bit weird for me, because I expected everyone to you know, to watch it live as I go. But the replay is what the people actually wanted. So I got like a few emails after the workshop from the other people that bought it, asking when the replay will be on. So yeah, it's available right now, by the way, if one of you is listening, it's available right now. So I just trimmed this down a little bit because we had the break in between. So it's like 2 hours and 40 minutes of me talking about Premiere stuff. And I think it's good. I think it, like, you know, again, like I didn't go into too much of basics over there. It's more about like, how do you use features that are available to your advantage, I guess. So it's tailored to editors who know Premiere pretty well, but at the same time aren't up to date with all of the features and what's new, what's been introduced in the past 2 years, let's say. And they haven't really used the text-based editing feature that much yet. Stuff like that, right? Yeah. So it was fun. It was fun. I think I'm going to do it in the future again. But yeah, probably on a different topic. We've got this one ready. So if I get some interesting questions about Premiere, or maybe we'll do another one day, not about Premiere, but about more like a storytelling aspect of editing. Yeah, maybe. We'll see.
All right. So, yeah, I played that disc golf tournament over the weekend. It was really fun. The weather was really shitty. Trying to throw like a 170-gram piece of plastic in, 20-mile-an-hour winds was challenging, but the weekend was fun. The weather progressed through the weekend, so it was fine, and I was with some good friends, and it was nice to be out and about and throwing discs. So it was good. I
And
didn't
get me
win.
frustrated with the wind.
Sometimes you could be, yeah. And then just like if there's trees and you're throwing, and then trees are a magnet for discs, and you're just hitting every tree in the forest, and you're like, that's frustrating. But yeah, I didn't get last, so that was awesome. Out of my category, there were 24 people, and I was in the middle of the pack, so I got 13th out of 24. So
Good. That's
I am
good, man.
not, yeah. So
Congrats.
I'm not mad. So, and then, I mean, it's a whole experience. It's not just how well you play. I mean, it is how well you play, but then everybody that's with you, it's fun and, whatever happens at the tournament. But anyway, I'm playing another tournament tomorrow. So,
Oh, seriously?
yeah, there's
Wow.
a local tournament that I'm playing that the club that I'm a part of is putting on. So I gotta, after we recut this, after we record, I gotta go over there and help them with setting stuff up for a little bit before I come back and sit down and work some
Okay,
more.
so it's nearby. You don't have to leave
No, it's
Germany
like,
for this one.
no. This is in Germany. So I was in Belgium last weekend. But anyway, I'm looking forward to that. But anyway, so Erwan's question. Do you want to just read it or do you want to just.
Go ahead. You'll do it better.
Okay, so Erwan's question was, he said, I'd be interested in hearing your take on editors working for influencers, YouTube, Instagram, TikTok, the style of editing that they use. Mr. Beast retention editing that got copied so much, which he just said he wished YouTubers would drop a bit. The YouTube algorithm dictating what is a good video, the good and the bad, etc. So there was an article. Wasn't there an article? He sent me an article that basically talks about that. And it's an interesting thing, or an interesting topic to say the least, because of how much Instagram and social media and the way that people edit and ingest media on those platforms. This is something that I hadn't even thought about before, because I, full disclosure, don't really watch a lot of Instagram. Well, not Instagram,
YouTube.
but yeah, but like YouTube stuff. But I mean, not to say that I didn't know that there was a specific style that people are trying to adhere to. But it was yeah, this is something that I hadn't really thought about until Erwan brought it up.
Yeah, the thing is, I understand Erwin's question quite well. YouTube is about the retention these days. I mean, not only because there is like a how satisfied you are, how happy you are after watching a certain video and stuff like that. That's something that they are actually measuring as well. you get those polls sometimes where you rate a video from like, satisfied this like, or whatever. But you rate them on a spectrum, and this gives another like signal to Premiere, sorry, to YouTube. But in general, the higher the watch time, the better retention, the more successful the video will be. And the algorithm is, it's what the people react to. So, to me, the most funny thing is that Mr. Beast says, like, that he would wish that YouTubers would drop it a bit. It doesn't work that way. I mean, the people are attracted to something that has a proven record of success. And that's something that always worked. But that's not the future as well. I think the future belongs to people that are actually doing things differently. But it doesn't mean they're gonna be successful right now. And that's the thing. That's the thing. Like I've listened to the conversation of Casey Neistat that Casey Neistat had with Paul Logan and his brother, and he said the same thing. Like, stop trying to imitate Mr. Beast. That's his advice for any YouTuber, right? stop trying to imitate him, because like the truth is that like the Jimmy Donaldson, he's the most influential YouTuber on the planet. That's for sure. He had like the biggest influence of how we watch YouTube these days and what YouTube is these days, I think, even bigger than Casey Neistat. But you know, he made a huge business out of YouTube, basically. This production level of his videos is insane, and that's actually the direction that YouTube seems to go to, where you have creators who spend like millions of dollars to shoot a video, you know, which is crazy on one hand, but at the same time, again, it's for what people are watching, and it's self-fulfilling prophecy in a way. So I don't think you can, I don't think you can close that Pandora box again. But the question, I guess, that everyone is trying to ask, is asking here, is should we go that route? Should we try to imitate, right, that Mr. Beast style?
I mean, an influencer is just a client, and they're going to kind of dictate the style, and the editor is definitely going to make their suggestions of like what you want to do. Mr. Beast has essentially created this retention editing, and it's been a style that has been kind of beaten into the ground, and only because it's been very, very successful for him and a lot of other people, that when people think of influencers on YouTube and whatever, this is the style that they think of. And now it's gotten to a point where it's been so overdone that even Mr. Beast is like, I'm tired of doing the same video over and over again, regardless of what the theme, if the theme is different. This editing style is just too much. And so now the article that Erwan sent me that he was talking about, that he had in mind, is a Washington Post article that we'll try to post it if I can find the article again. But essentially, it was stating that there are a lot of other influencers on level with Mr. Beast that are starting to do just long videos with no editing in it, and they're getting just as good or even better views on these new videos that they're posting and stuff. Now, to your point, like once the Pandora's box is open, then everybody is going to be doing that because they see the success and they can get easy success with that. But when you've got something like Mr. Beast and other influencers that have been doing this for many, many years, and they're getting tired of that, creating content like that, their viewers will also start getting tired of watching that content. And so when you start slowing things down, not making everything so flashy, like video game, then those, you're going to have more of a retention, especially with your original audience.
That's true. Although like the thing is that it's not, you said like easy success, right? It's like, it's proven track record. That's what I would call it. Not necessarily easy success, because none of it is easy, right? And on YouTube, the thing is like that the connection matters. Like, you know, if you're able to create connection with the audience, some kind of relationship, then you're good to go, right? But creating that relationship is very difficult. It's not easy at all. And yeah, people will get tired of that formula, and there will be another formula that will replace it. I mean, there are multiple formulas, right? But I guess you've mentioned, like, you know, not really edited, long-winded videos that get traction as well. Do they get traction on small channels? I don't think so.
Yeah, that's the thing.
They get traction if it's like a Casey Neistat video. If it's a PewDiePie video, then they get traction and they get viewership, because because they come from people that kind of like proven themselves already and are interesting to people already, right? I've heard someone giving this advice that you should try to be vulnerable online, and that's what like people respond to. You should try to be vulnerable, try to talk about like, you know, your failures, stuff like that. And the thing is, it works, but it works for people who have been successful already. If there is a person that is successful and then they're vulnerable about how difficult it's been and the struggle that they have been through, you know, drugs, alcohol, whatever, right? Then we root for them. But if it would be just like, just a guy from the street, having like 50 videos with like 100 views on YouTube, and he would open up about his struggles with his addictions and whatever, people would hate it. So I think the
That's what
same.
we think that we never that's but that's the other thing is that there's that wild card of like you never know what's gonna what people are gonna get to. And there's somebody who was just talking about how much they've been shit on all their life and they're still being shit on. There is going to be an audience for that, and they're gonna now how big that audience is, who knows? But yeah, to your point, like if it was Mr. Beast slowing everything down, then he already has the built-in audience that's going to be like, oh, this is different. I'm going to watch it now, compared to like if I posted something on my YouTube channel, which has got nothing on it, no one's going to care because they're like, no, but the algorithm is not good for me. Nobody cares. Nobody knows. I'm at the
I
bottom of the
mean,
list.
again, the algorithm is what people react to. But people react to if it's a long-winded video, a long one, where you talk about in details about something without snapping editing, or a very like grabbing story, a very terrifying or whatever story, right? Then it's just difficult to get people's attention, and you will not get that initial boost from YouTube because people are not really like interacting with it with the content the way that YouTube wants people to interact.
Yeah, it still needs to be compelling. The whatever the content is, regardless of, well, like I said, there's so many factors as you can attest to what makes a successful YouTube video, but it has to be compelling and there has to be an audience for it. I'm not sure if that we answered Erwan's question, but yeah, I don't know. I know that Erwan, he edits for a YouTuber, and obviously I've edited for you and you are a YouTuber, but beyond that, like, yeah, I don't know what more we can say about it. Here I am failing. You're hearing me fail, guys. I mean, I don't know what more to say about this, but it's an interesting thing. Like nothing is ever,
I mean,
there's so much.
I think that like everyone mostly questions whether he should try to imitate
I don't know.
that snappy editing or not. And I think for most creators, yeah, you should try to imitate it to some extent, probably. Probably. But the I mean, seriously, I think so, because like although, like maybe I'm very wrong here, because like the thing is like follow the data, what the data says, right? So for every creator, it's probably a little bit different. For most creators, the snappy editing is what will work better. That's for sure. Like not for sure, but that's probably what the data is gonna show. But if you're working for the creator, I think it's important to actually ask them for retention graphs to see how and or maybe even have access to YouTube Studio in the for the analytics, right? There are some like restrictions that the YouTuber can post on a given person to access their YouTube Studio. And one of those, I think, is just being able to watch the data, watch the analytics of the videos. And I think it's good to have access to something like that. For example, I'll give you an example. I'll brag maybe a little bit, but I also will fail. So both. I'm not. I don't have very good retention on most of my YouTube videos. I'll cut to the point. Most of them have like 30-35% retention, which is not good. Which is not good. Like YouTube, I think you need to have 50 above. That's a good retention rate. But I checked some time ago. I checked the retentions on the videos that I have edited for Maps Pathway, my previous client, and most of them were 60-65% retention rate, which is very good. Which is very good. I've spent time to make sure that the story is coherent and that it flows. And it shows up in the retention. Somehow I can't do it on my own channel when I'm writing the content, I guess. But it's good to see that, right? And I think that yeah, like judge the data. If you edit two different videos, or you make a change in the way you approach the opening, or you think differently about re-engaging throughout. Compare the two. Try to find like two similar videos that have different editing for your client, right? Compare the two, see which one works better, and then go with that. I think that's probably the best thing you can do. That's also the advice that I've heard from many YouTube gurus, I guess. Follow the data, what the data says, right? Yeah, it's not easy. It's not easy to do it. It's also very difficult to find videos that are comparable, because very often like videos are so different from one another that you can't really compare them. But if you can, you should probably test these things and then go with whatever works. Unless, of course, because there is always buts to something, right? Unless the main goal is not the viewership, because sometimes it's not, right? There are creators that would care much more about creating two very good relationships via the video they're posting rather than 10,000 of views and not really, and the viewership that is like, you know, good, but at the same time, not very good. They're not creating that relationship. So I guess, you know, it depends. It always depends. What's the goal of the channel? What's the business, so to speak, right? What they're after, what the creator of the channel is after. And then judging if that snappy editing or maybe a slower one is actually contributing to that success. So as always, you have to, I guess, define what the success for a given creator is. Maybe that's even a question that we could add to, you know, the list of questions you should ask your client. How do you define success, right? Because then you can make decisions based on the answers, right? And that's something that we do all the time in the editing room, right? We ask ourselves the questions, and we make decisions based on the answers we give ourselves. So yeah, I think that's my take on it. That's my take on it, Erwan. I'm not sure if it's helpful, but I hope it is.
Yeah, I think that. Yeah, I just quickly, I'll try to mention, but even as being an editor and not necessarily, I'm curious as to how much, because he's an editor of YouTube videos as well as you are. I mean, you are also like, the difference is Erwan is working for a YouTuber, whereas you are the YouTuber doing your own work. And I'm curious as to know how much the Erwan's boss or is being like, this is what we need to do for this edit, rather than like, here's the footage, make it compelling. And I think based off of the article, there's a specific formula of these retention editing that's like, cut every 1.5 seconds, cut every 1.8 seconds, where there's like, it's very straightforward.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. To the point.
Where that's like
re-engage to the point, and
and to a certain point, like once you get into that, for lack of a better term, like pattern or whatever that technique, then editing videos, regardless of the theme or whatever it is, kind of becomes easy, or just because okay, I know what I need to do here, and I'll sit down. I mean, for my own work, even though it wasn't an influencer, I worked back in the day on court videos, day in the life videos, basically just showing somebody who got hurt in an accident. Really badly, their quality of life was terrible, and so they needed care all the time. And so these videos were basically just so to get them more money so that they could live longer and, like, you know, have nurses and whatever, doctors. But it was very specific, like, this is a day in the life video, it's got to be this long, we need to show these things, we don't need to be long-winded. It doesn't necessarily wasn't about like, okay, we need 1.5 seconds of this, we need 2 seconds of this, but it was very specific, like these are the hot things that we need to hit. And after a while, I could cut, if there was like 2 hours of footage, I could cut that in 2 hours because I knew what was going, because I didn't need to listen or watch the content. I could just fast forward it, find the thing I needed, cut it, and then move on to the next thing. And I don't know if it's the same with editors for influencers, being in that kind of factory editing mode, but you're basically taking out all the creativity of something. And then it just becomes a chore. And you're just like, okay.
I'm not sure if I agree with that, to be
honest.
Well,
I'm just saying, like, I'm I would know, or we would know.
I mean, I will give you another example. Reality TV. Very formulaic. But I don't think you could say that there is no creativity in it. It's also very actually similar to you know, retention editing.
Right, but if you're doing the same thing over and over again, it's just habit. And there's not, like, if it's just the same thing, it becomes monotonous. I'm not saying that the end endeavor can't be creative. Given what I was working on, there didn't need to be creative. It was just very utilitarian. Like, this is what we need. Give it to us. There were no bells and whistles. It was just like, this is what you need to talk about. Compared to, like, obviously with an influencer's video, it's much more creative. I'm saying in the sense of what you're doing, what you're working on, it's like, okay, I'm cutting it this way, and this is the way that it needs to be cut. It's not like, it's not creating something from new. It's just like, okay, we're doing this video on cars, but I'm cutting it this way. I'm doing this video on flowers. I'm cutting it the exact same way, even though it's a different theme. And that, I think,
I mean, you still make adjustments. You still make adjustments. I don't think you can, like, you know, you still make adjustments. That's for sure. Even, like, you know, Mr. Beast's videos are different as well. Like, the details are different. Not just the, you know, the editing is not exactly the same. They still make adjustments. It uses the same formula in a way, but the details of how you solve it are different. And they depend on the theme, on the topic, on the content, and so on. But I think also, like, you know, when you think about this, about, like, cutting, you know, half a second there, half a second there, and stuff like that, again, reality TV is very much about that. Very much about, like, just showing the interesting bits and changing the camera angles very often and stuff like that. I don't know. Like, you know, the story repeats itself.
I'm not saying that people wouldn't like that and there wouldn't be value to it. But I feel like after a certain time, you kind of get tired of working on that stuff. Or else, you know,
that's for
my
sure.
own thing, it's like I work on so many different videos or so much different style of video, whether it be awareness video, corporate commercials, you know, films at this point. And I like it that way. I'm not just specifically working on
it. I know
what
you mean.
So
I like it this way as well. But reality is that a lot of people have this kind of repetition in their line of work. And that's fine as well, I guess. You have to learn how to spice it up sometimes. And trying to diversify is a good way, as always.
Yeah, and there's some people that don't want to diversify. I mean, I know reality TV editors.
I don't mean just like diversifying income.
No. I'm talking about the content that you're editing and whatever. Anyway.
Maybe. Although, yeah, I agree. Like, people get, like, you know, burnt out if they just do the same thing over and over again. So I think it's important to actually think about how you break the pattern. You know, it could be something else. It doesn't have to be like editing a different project. Maybe breaking a pattern for you is just having like some kind of different hobby that also takes a lot of time in your life. Whatever, right? But yeah. Trying to balance the thing with, yeah. Anyway, we're off the tangent here.
Yeah, well, I'm kind of related, unrelated. Anyway, hopefully that, well, I guess Erwan will tell us if we answer this question or not. But if anybody has any other questions or things they want to tell us, you know, we have an Instagram, and then also there's information in the description of this episode so you can reach out to us. So we're always curious to know what you guys think. So
always.
Let us know.
That's true.
Always. All right. What's next?
Tell me about video AI. Because you've posted an article over here. I just skimmed through it. I haven't read like word for word, but you've mentioned here that Vimeo, Frame, and other platforms are using content to train AI, right? So talk about this a little bit more.
Right. So the company that I'm working with right now, somebody had posted on Slack, not a sponsor, somebody had posted something about this, and it's kind of an interesting thing to talk about, or even realize is that Vimeo, even though they aren't starting it, but they're creating surveys where they're essentially talking with their users about using Vimeo to train their AI. And by using Vimeo, I mean like all the content that's on AI. It hasn't been implemented yet, but it's probably going to someday happen. I think that Vimeo is pretty conscious about keeping their users happy. So it seems like they're being very transparent about it, where people will be able to opt out if they don't want to do it. But Vimeo probably may be the exception, because maybe like other platforms similar to Vimeo may not be doing that, and they're creating AI tools that are just using everything within their library or what's on their platform to train AI. And so it becomes kind of like very shady.
Yeah. But on the other hand, like ChatGPT, right? It was trained on the things accessible on the World Wide Web, and no one ever asked.
but that's also a platform that is out in the world. That's not something, I mean, obviously you're paying to plug into it, but it's not something that you're paying to be like, I'm putting all of my content on there because I want to specifically put it on this thing. Even though, I mean, that's arguable too, but there's a difference in it where it's like, okay, I want this up there, but it becomes like that copyright argument of like, okay, this is work that you guys are taking advantage of and not telling me that you're doing it, and I'm not getting any credit for it, whether it be monetarily or otherwise. And so it becomes very the gray
area. But
they're
asking, right? They're asking.
With Vimeo definitely is. I don't know about other things. I mean, who knows with these things, but that was kind of the thing that I thought was interesting, or kind of like, oh, great. Something else about AI that, you know, can become nefarious in another Pandora's box where everybody's like, this is a great idea, and then it ruins everyone's lives.
I mean, if you post something online, if something is public, then it's out of your hands already. People can do stuff with it, and you have to accept it in a way.
Right.
Yeah, it's good if company asks if they have intentions of using it. I bet that in that AI training era that we're in, there will be and there is and there was a lot of situations where they didn't ask and they used stuff that was available publicly to train the models.
Yeah.
And to be honest, like, you know, as frustrating as it is, I don't think there is anything you can do about it.
Yeah. And hopefully that they'll give you some insight into it and be like, this is what we're doing. FYI, read the fine print, because if you're going to be upset. And I think, you know, I know that I remember Instagram saying stuff like, if you post a video on Instagram, we're going to use it for something else and you can't complain. So if you want to keep using Instagram, then you have to agree to this.
Yes.
So,
exactly.
And it's kind of like how, what's the word?
Nothing is free. Instagram is not free.
No. Like,
that's
yeah,
it, right? That's their product. Their product is our data.
Yeah.
Our data and our content in a way as well, right? That's their product. That's nothing else. So.
Yeah, it's kind of like the if you see something on TV that you don't like, just turn it off. If you don't want to be a part of it, you can just not be a part of it. It's not, you know. And I don't
exactly,
think,
which doesn't mean it's not going to affect your life, because the way world works right now is that it will affect your life. Everything affects your life. If you're not on YouTube, on Facebook or whatever, yes, you're not contributing to that. But it doesn't mean that the stuff that isn't over there, people that are over there, aren't affecting your life as well, in a way. I don't think there is just a way of dealing with this stuff other than just to accept it.
Which kind of sucks.
Which kind of sucks.
It is what it is. And hopefully things won't be so nefarious.
I bet that like in 10 years we'll have a lot of TV series that are nostalgic about it, the times where we have it these days. You know,
yeah, we'll
see. The nostalgic aspect of TV shows that are pre-social media era is a real thing, I think.
Well, it's happening right now. Like all these things that are coming out from the 80s
right now, that's
and
for sure.
the 70s.
Yeah, exactly.
And I think it's because a lot of the people that are writing that grew up in that time and they remember, like, oh, remember when it was much easier when we didn't have a cell phone or a beeper or people weren't so whatever. But anyway, so
and
that's
will
something
be the same for the pre-AI era as well. We'll have TV shows that will be nostalgic about this. Remember yeah. where you just couldn't write a prompt and get something out of AI tool? Remember that time? It was so awesome.
Yeah. Oh, man. We're fucked. Anyway, moving on. So, yeah, I don't know. Think about that. That's something to heads up, everybody, just so you know.
I've seen one of your favorite movies. Maybe even the favorite one. I think you've mentioned that it's your favorite.
Yeah. I saw it on the list.
Do you really have like one favorite?
I mean, I have like a top five, but that's what when I think of a movie that's my favorite movie, it's The Royal Tenenbaums.
Wow.
Because that, to me, that movie's perfect. I mean, I think that's out of Wes Anderson's catalog, that's the movie, that's like the best movie that every time I watch, I'm like, this is so fucking good. But yeah. And you watched it and...
I watched it. I liked it, but I'm not sure if I would call it the best Wes Anderson's movie.
Okay.
I think I like Fantastic Mr. Fox better.
Okay. I mean, that's also a great movie.
Yeah. But I'm curious, like, what makes it so special to you, the Royal Tenenbaums?
I think when I saw that film, I think that was the first Wes Anderson movie that I saw, because I didn't see Rushmore, and I honestly still haven't seen his first movie, which I just blanked on it anyway. But seeing it was very different at the time, but also like being so invested in those characters and the whole kind of like leading up to the movie, like that opening that monologue isn't right, but getting the backstory of the Tenenbaums and like all the kids and setting that all up and understanding, like, once you got to them in adult, or you know, at present when we're in the movie, like, it just looks so good. And then all of those, it's very complicated, all those characters, and you know, all of them are very flawed, and you know, I don't know, there's just something about it. And then Wes Anderson's composition, everything that he composites is so beautiful. So I don't know, it was just so different than what I had seen before, and I still love it. It's just still so good.
This makes sense. Yeah. Yeah, definitely one of the top, that's for sure. I'm glad I caught up with it.
Yeah, I think that it's just like the pacing of it. There's never a time, and for me, in watching that movie, there's never a time, even when I first saw it, where it was like, okay, let's
move
on.
It doesn't slow down.
It's not like the pacing is insane.
Retention editing all the way.
Yeah, but it's like also like not, you know, it moves in such a way where you're retaining it and you're moving on. You're completely enamored, not enamored. I can't think of the word, but you know, you're invested.
Immersed.
In it.
Yeah, I get it. I get it. I totally agree. And to the point where it's like the pacing is perfect, pretty much. I agree with that. Like, you know, you learn about everything you need to learn in the time that it takes to learn it. In a way, right? It's not too slow, it's not too fast.
Wes Anderson's use of song and slow motion and like is so good. Like I've
oh,
heard
yeah,
that
the music. I've noticed it as well. Yeah. The music choices here are great.
Yeah, and I've heard that he writes his scripts with songs in mind. Like, they're not like, oh, well, maybe we'll use this. It's like, okay, we're going to use this song. I wrote the Ramones song that we're going to use for this section. And that's going to go in there, which is pretty awesome. So
Quentin Tarantino, I think, is the same for
him. Oh, yeah. Probably. Very deliberate writers.
Yeah. By the way, have you ever read one of Wes Anderson's scripts?
I haven't. I've seen, I think I saw the hardcover of Grand Budapest Hotel, or maybe?
Yes.
There's another one.
Yes,
I think they did
like
it for
a script book for the Grand Budapest Hotel.
Yeah,
which
he writes.
I like the film. I haven't read the script, but I like the film a lot as well.
Yeah, I've heard that he's very, for lack of a better term, long-winded. Like, he's writing a book. It's not just like, script that's just lines and like, man, then they fought.
I've read the script for the French Dispatch, the French Dispatch. Without that, I think. And it's, for me, it's almost unreadable. Seriously, because like he's so specific. He's so specific in his writing that it paralyzes me, seriously. Especially since he uses a lot of words that for me, not being a native, aren't those like, you know, easy to read words through. So yeah, like very difficult script to read for me. I'm not sure if it's so bad in a way, quote unquote, for all of his movies, for all of his scripts. I think that French Dispatch might be on a, you know, on the top of the scale here, but yeah, it's very difficult to read. Yeah, yeah,
yeah. It's seriously, very specific,
like so detailed. Like he describes everything, like, you know, the color of whatever and the texture of the thing that they use in the scene or whatever. Everything is described. Everything.
Yeah, I wonder if that's just because he's in the same way that, yeah, that's just his own idiosyncratic method of working, but he's also the director and he's thinking of everything.
Yes,
and so he's writing it in his script. And I haven't read Quentin Tarantino's scripts, but I assume that his are more specific,
they're not as maybe. Specific. I'm sure they're not as specific. I haven't read his scripts either, but I'm sure they're not. Like I've read, for example, I read Parasite, John Bong Ho, right, script, you know, it's still a writer-director, right? And it's like a normal screenplay. But Wes Anderson's is like completely different. Like where you get like two pages of just scene description without any dialogue. Any dialogue, like two pages straight, right? So it's like, it's crazy. I have never seen scripts like this. Yeah. So I'm not sure. I'm like 99% sure that Quentin Tarantino is not describing things as meticulously as Wes Anderson is. And I don't think that many writers are. Which is his style. That's his style. That's the way he does things. Good, I guess. Yeah. But, you know, Parasite script. I was curious when I watched this film. I was curious about what's different from the script. Because often, like, films are different than scripts, right? And in here, it's like, it's almost one-to-one, like, and I guess this is the proof of the vision and the strong storytelling skills that you can't edit things out of it, basically. There are, like, in Parasite, there are, like, two micro scenes, or maybe not even micro scenes, I think just moments or something like that. A few moments, basically, that they cut out of the script. I mean, that they didn't use in the film. But just a few. Like, probably if you would sum it up, it would be like 1 minute of running time, something like that. So pretty much next to nothing, right? Yeah. Very, very close to the script.
That's crazy. Because most scripts don't always make it to the stage or to the screen. So yeah, to hear about that. But also to prove that, you know, making movies, there isn't kind of a wrong way to write a movie or to, everybody has their own style and sees success in it.
Yeah, although.
But.
yeah. I mean, if you're able to pull it off, then you're able to pull it off. Then the format doesn't matter that much and how you write doesn't matter that much. If the story is strong and you're able to pull it off and people eventually like it, then whatever, right? Do your thing.
Well, yeah, I think that successfully making a movie is different than having a successful movie.
Yeah, exactly.
So, but Anyway.
But if the two things correlate, then and if you have a weird writing style, then just keep doing it.
Truth.
I've seen the Shogun finale.
Okay.
Which I liked a lot. So for anyone listening who has seen Shogun as well, you know what I'm talking about. If you haven't seen Shogun, then I strongly recommend it. Not sponsored by FX. Which, by the way, last time I said Disney because I watched it on Disney. But yeah, the series belongs to FX, not Disney. Anyway, it's quite a series.
Did they set it up for a second season, or is it just
no? Okay. I hope so. But I'm like 99% pretty much sure. I'm sure that they're not, because like it's not a ongoing thing. It's basically a finished story, and you know it's based on the book and stuff like that. So I haven't read the book, so I don't know. Maybe there is more to it, but I don't think so, because basically they, you know, what's gonna happen next. You know, that's the thing. That's the and also very interesting aspect to me about this thing is that I was wondering, like, will there be a final battle in the final season, in the final episode, sorry. And there kind of isn't, but you know what's the outcome of the battle based on how they did it. But it's mostly just about, like, you know, it's mostly people talking about stuff. And I tend to like it. It's my thing where if there is like a dialogue that is very dramatic and you there is a lot of tension in the dialogue, then it's kind of my thing. I like it. And there is this aspect to it. But the overall, like, you know, when you hear Shogun, you think about many battles and stuff like that. There isn't many battles in that TV show. There is just a few fights, just a few battles, more like fights actually than battles. But each one of those is powerful. That's the thing. And the best one, or the best of all, is with the female lead character in the second to last season. So freaking good. And like, you know, I don't know. I think that Japanese people, I mean, it's a Japanese-American show, so like both, but they know how to write strong female characters. Yeah, seriously.
A lot of strong female characters in Japanese cinema, for sure. That's cool. I was asking my wife if she wanted to watch it. I don't think she was very interested, but I can remember when that first came out in the States, and it being kind of like a limited series. And, it, you know, I think that the trailer for Shogun now makes it a little bit more action-packed than the way that you're describing it, because it's essentially a drama about people talking about stuff. So, but yeah, I'd still be kind of interested. Because how many episodes? Is it just 8 episodes, or is it less than
10,
that?
10 episodes.
Okay.
Yeah.
And it's like 45 minutes an episode?
More like an hour. Yeah, but some of them are shorter, of course, right? These days, that's how they do it, which I like it. I like it. I mean, imagine like having to cut for TV and having to hit like a 45-minute mark every time.
Yeah, that's not possible.
And you had like maybe 1 minute of wiggle time just to, you know, for the commercial break or whatever. Yeah, man, I'm glad that like most TV is not doing it anymore. Some of them are, of course, but still, most of them will still have much more flexibility to the length of the episodes than what it used to be, I guess.
Because before streaming services, everybody had to be in a specific time slot and take an account for commercials and whatever and what was coming before and after. But yeah, that actress... whose name is Anna. Sawai.
Yeah.
Sawai? She's been in a couple things. She was on the, she was in that Godzilla series that's on Apple Plus, Monarch with Kurt Russell.
Mm-hmm.
She's pretty good in that. There's some writing in that is kind of whatever, but yeah, she's kind of on the up and up, I think. We'll probably see more of her
I've heard actually, because I've listened to the podcast I've mentioned last time, right? On the podcast, as I've listened to the official podcast for Shorgan. And she mentions in one of the episodes that she was actually very reluctant to that kind of acting that she was required to perform over there for that series, because she kind of didn't know how it's going to work out. And it was very tense. All of it was very tense. And it seemed to be this kind of heavy thing. And she wasn't really sure how it's going to come out, right? So she was like, I'm not sure if I like it. But then when she saw the final result and how it all came together in the editing, and actually that was very interesting because she is the only actress in that podcast that mentions that the editors did such an amazing job of putting it all together. So this was very interesting to hear as well. She like acknowledges that the like performance, sure, one thing, but then the way you put the performance together is very crucial, right? And she said that like after seeing the final result, she wants to do nothing else, just stuff like this. Right?
Oh wow!
I mean that level of intensity and stuff like that, because like the it's so rewarding, and her character is like a very powerful character, in that series, and also like she's a strong wind. She's a strong wind. She changes things. Yeah, she's not the main character of the series, not even the second to main. I think she's like the third. But still, I think that the power of her wind is, I don't know, I would say that the strongest, seriously.
That's cool. Yeah, definitely it's on my list. So hopefully I can get around to it. But yeah, I want to see more. Japanese cinema in general, and then, you know, the romance of, you know, samurai and Japanese culture is always a big draw for me in the movies that I like to see and watch, regardless of if it's action, which is what I more lean to, but even
I need to see Seven drama. Samurais, which I know is a scene that I haven't seen yet. But,
oh, that's a movie. That's a great film.
Yeah, I actually have it on DVD over here.
Oh, wow, yeah.
And I've had this DVD for a while, but I haven't seen it yet.
Have you watched The Magnificent Seven?
No, but I know what you're talking about. What you're talking about, yeah.
Yeah, that's what Magnificent Seven is based off of. It's good. It's probably one of my favorite of his movies. But yeah, we'll talk about it when you watch it. And
exactly,
I might rewatch
exactly.
It also because it's, yeah, it's good. It's really good. All right.
Thank you guys for tuning in for today. Again, we'd love to hear from you.
Yeah, find all the description. In the description is where you can find where you can contact us and whatever. Don't forget, we have an Instagram and it's Friday. So I hope you guys all have a great weekend. Until next time, have fun.
Bye-bye.